Africa will love. Africa will love. We love, 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 Africa will love. Yes, root of creation, mother of a civilization, heir of a victim. Oh, Western exploitation. Your gold is so rich, yet there's separation, huh? In your mess. So I gotta sing like Jah bless Africa. Tell them I'm about Jah bless Africa. I wanna let them know, say Jah bless Africa. The first and of a people so terrible from the beginning. I'm gonna tell you, hey, land of my fathers, which I love to be, and of a people so black, so great, so mighty. So I gotta sing like Jah bless Africa.
Welcome to WFT 90.1 Champagne. My name is Targi B. Swallow. I'm the host of Liberation Radio, but this segment is called Africa Focus, here again on 90.1 Champagne. I'm joined today with Professor Fanon Chair Wilkins, who's a history professor at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Along with Professor Wilkins, I'm joined with Sean Tandy. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
Today we're going to be talking about the contribution of African Americans, Africans in the Americas, and the diaspora to the continent of Africa. But before we begin our discussion for the day, why don't we introduce yourself to the audience, your research area, your interests, and I think we'll begin with Professor Wilkins.
Yeah, my name is Fanon Che Wilkins. I'm in the Department of African American Studies Research Program in the Department of History, and assistant professor in both those units. My research area focuses on the 60s radicalism and the global contours of 60s radicalism, particularly with regard to African-American and Afro sort of Caribbean interests in the African continent. during the 1960s, or the turbulent years of the 1960s and 70s. And so I'm interested in how the politics of African liberation and solidarity activity played itself out over the course of the 1960s, and in some ways was foundational to the anti-apartheid movement that would take shape in the United States from the late 70s up until Nelson Mandela's release in the early 90s.
Very well. Sean?
Okay. Like you said, I'm a graduate student in Ed Psych and also in African Studies, and my main areas of concentration at this point, which are definitely a many-splendored thing and a dynamic and changing thing often. But I'm looking at this concept called stereotype threat, which looks at African-Americans taking, particular African-Americans in my case, in test-taking situations and how that test-taking situation impacts their achievement, their approach to achievement. Then also we have a concept I'm working with, which is centers around black kids in the classroom, and how classroom is not just an academic experience, but also a social experience. And so how black kids' interpretation of the social interactions and the dynamics within that environment are impacting their motivation and then also their achievement.
Very well. Should be an interesting discussion for the day.
Yeah, it always is. Always is. Right.
So. Right. First of all, let me just begin by, and this question, I guess I'm going to direct it to you, Fanon. It's a simple question. It's not simple as it is, but it's just, I'll just go ahead and say it. Anyway, and ask it. Why, or rather, how did intellectual migration by Africans in North America and the Caribbean back to Mother Africa came about? What was the motivation for all this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that, you know, first of all, we have to think about the fact that, you know, that African-American or Afro-Caribbean or Afro-North American / Caribbean interest in the continent has been a longstanding one. From the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade, of course, Africans, voluntarily, jumped overboard, and many tried to figure out ways to return to the African continent. We see that over the course of the 17th and 18th century, African Americans in particular were, in direct solidarity and worked collaboratively with some tension, but with the Spaniards in Florida, we saw Maroon communities develop where there was a instinctive interest or desire to actually create communities, autonomous communities that existed outside the slaveocracy. And then, of course, when we come into the 19th century, we can see sort of the development of organized forms of, black nationalism and even Pan-Africanist ideas coming out of the late 19th century into the 20th century. We can think of, the Garvey movement. We can think about the African-American interest in Ethiopia, the ways in which they challenged in the 1930s, Italy's invasion of Ethiopia. And so there's a long history of African-American interest. We think about the 1960s, or sort of the post-1945 period. African-Americans, of course, took a concerted interest in the African continent, primarily because of, sort of the rising anti-colonial tide that would sweep the continent and much of the colonial world in the 1940s, going into the 1950s. And we see with Ghana's independence in 1957 that a significant number of African-American activists traveled, moved to Ghana. People like Julian Mayfield, the great African-American novelist and writer, folks like Maya Angelou, poet laureate in the U.S., and active artists and so forth, Leslie Lacey. There was a whole range of activists, and there's a wonderful book I think that's on the way by Kevin Gaines on the African-American presence in Ghana. So this is sort of a historical backdrop to what we see if we think about the contemporary moment or the 1980s and 90s. African-Americans responded to the continent. One, because it provided an alternative. There was in some respects, some of the countries like Guinea and Tanzania You know, those of which who propose a kind of socialist alternative were very attractive for black radicals and black activists who were attempting to challenge what was going on here in the U.S. And look for alternatives outside in the international arena outside the United States. So, you know, this was a political interest as well as an intellectual interest, but also a cultural interest. People attempting to try to rediscover themselves, figure out their, you know, sort of own family heritage, but also make sense of their kind of everyday politics. And so Africa, you know, because of its sort of new development after the 1945, when we see the United States kind of ascend to sort of a world superpower, it becomes a major beacon, you know, for an alternative. And so you just have a range of people going for a variety of reasons. And many of their ideas and many of their notions of what Africa offered, oftentimes those things were challenged, and they had to sort of rethink, you know, their presence there. But a good number of 60s radicals, people like Pete O'Neill and Charlotte O'Neill, ex-Panther Party, people who are living in Ibasimi, right outside of Arusha in Tanzania, people like Geronimo Pratt, who also... you know, who spent 27 years in prison, who now lives in Tanzania and Ibasimi, which I had an opportunity to visit and spend some time, but also lives in Ghana. People like Daruba bin Wahad, who was part of the New York 21 and spent 18 years in prison, is now living in Ghana. So you just have a whole range of activists. South Africa, of course, is a real hotbed of African American interests, and again, those interests vary. Some of, you know, I would say progressive political interests. Others are, you know, quasi kind of business entrepreneurial interests. Just a range of things. So we can talk about it more extensively as we go on. But.
Okay, Sean, you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, I pretty much wouldn't say much more than that. I think he covered a majority of the things that I would pretty much would cover myself. But in particular, I would like to sort of emphasize this notion of. Sort of resisting, reconstructing, resisting and reconstructing in terms of resisting imperialism in all of its forms, in particular European imperialist efforts in other nations, in particular in Africa. And then also if you start looking at the notion of the black community within the United States as a form of a colony, so in sort of in similar to what Huey Newton, or Dr. Huey Newton, put forth in his book in terms of being an intercommunal or a colony within a colony, an internal colony.
Right.
And so you start to see these similarities in terms of existing in that contemporary moment, which is the early, middle, late 19th century or 20th century, I'm sorry. And so you sort of see that desire, that intellectual migration coming about as a result of trying to resist those efforts. But then also as an outgrowth of that, you have this, as Dr. Fanon Wilkins mentioned a second ago, you have this sort of need to reconstruct or to create something new that's here in the States,
right?
Predicated upon what was there in Africa, or this sort of notion, maybe some people would call it romantic notion, of what was there in Africa as a result to sort of reclaim one's identity to move forward in this contemporary context.
I would actually like to add something to that. I think that's a really good point in terms of, you know, thinking about the continent as a kind of space where, you know, those who were violently dispersed, you know, as a result of the transatlantic slave trade, you know, often looked to Africa as a way to sort of reconstruct their identity. But I think it's also important, you know, we also talk about, you know, the ways in which black people in the West oftentimes romanticize the African continent, see it as this sort of, you know, panacea for everything wrong in their life, and they go there and they can change everything.
Right.
And oftentimes when they get there, they realize that, you know, the problems are, you know, much more complicated, you know, than they would have, you know, initially thought from afar.
Sure.
But I think what's also important, and this is something we've learned from a lot of some of the you know, art historians of the continent, and that is that, you know, this notion of returning back is always seen as a sort of a diasporic phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. But we never think about that on the African continent itself, the kind of divides between the rural and urban spaces, where you have African artists who in attempting to try to produce modern art or different forms of art, oftentimes find themselves returning to the quote-unquote bush and returning back to the villages and so forth as a way to try to reclaim their own heritage. Mm-hmm. Because right. in many respects, because of the colonial experience, their own sense of who they are is up for grabs and something that they struggle with. So I think at this notion that this is primarily just a diasporic phenomenon, we have to also think internally on the continent, that the continent actually, mm-hmm. you know, that people on the continent are also searching for themselves for a variety of reasons. And then when we think about it like that, then we can sort of get beyond this kind of factual discussion about identity politics and see how this is a real serious desire, not only for black people, but for all people. You know, we see people, you know, in Chicago who go back to Ireland and are searching for, you know, their sense of self and Irish communities, Scottish communities, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and then these also not just for those who are dispersed, but for those who are also still living in those particular, you know, places in the world.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I want to add one more piece to that, too, in terms of, you know, reclaiming your identity. I think a lot of it is, as he mentioned earlier, this notion of alternative. A lot of us are really searching for a viable alternative for how we exist contemporarily.
Right.
And so a lot of, and then also grounding that in a reality that we feel like we can potentially, possibly relate with. Mm-hmm. And so in this longing to sort of reclaim or reconstruct or whatever your particular, you know, goal is in this moment, going back to Africa to find that, I think, is probably one of the ways that we've done it. And then also, just to take another note, in terms of the interest, the reasons for going back were also corporate and military. And so there were people who took an active interest in freeing Africa, or not necessarily freeing Africa, but in being involved in African affairs for corporate reasons, you know, trying to make money off the diamond trade, mines, rubber, coca, you know, bauxite, in terms of creating the technology for computers and cell phones and whatnot. And so
yeah.
there are other interests besides just this longing, this sort of nostalgic, amorphous notion of, you know, Africa, you know, and Africa is in me, you know. So thanks.
Oh, very well put. Anyway, in case you're just joining us, we're listening to WFT 90.1 Champaign. I'm joined with Professor Fanon Wilkins. Dr. Wilkins is here along with Sean Tundy. We're discussing some issues that are close to our heart, so to speak.
Fascism.
You know, we're discussing African American and diaspora contributions to the continent of Africa. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
I'm an African, and I know what's happening. public can remember that. Most of the cats we know be hustling. My mama worked all her life and still struggling. I blame it on the government and say it on the radio. And if you don't already know, all these Uncle Tom ass kissing niggas got to go.
Welcome back. That was Dead Prez, hip hop group here in the States. If you don't know about them, check them out. Their album Let's Get Free came out several years ago. Again, my name is Targi Biswala. I'm hosting this show today from Liberation Radio Focus Africa. I'm joined with Fanon Wilkins, professor of history at the University of Illinois, and Sean Tandy, also from the University of Illinois.
Graduate student extraordinaire.
There you go. There you go. Anyway, since we just heard Dead Prez talking, singing, rapping, whatever, about I'm an African, I'll pose this question to both of you, and I don't know if we should start with either one. Maybe
start with the eldest as always.
It's an African thing, you know?
Right.
Yeah, man,
I'm an elder now.
He's an elder now.
Elder than I. That's what I'm saying. All right. It's a relative notion. You know?
Right. Anyway, drawing from your own experiences, and I've heard this before, you know, people are always talking, it's always that notion that's out there. How do you respond to the claim that there's a lack of enthusiasm about the continent and the future of the continent, both in its intellectual development and economic social development amongst today's African-American and diaspora youths and Caribbean and so forth?
Yeah, I think that there has definitely been a wane or an ebb in terms of interest in the continent. I think that in many respects, it's also sort of reflective of the sort of lack of, you know, larger kind of political engagement or social movement engagement with the continent. If we think about the late 1960s and early 70s, when we saw, you know, some of the, you know, major kind of national liberation movement activity in places like Zimbabwe, or when Rhodesia would become Zimbabwe, we think of Guinea-Bissau, and we think of the PAIGC and Amilcar Cabral, and we think Mozambique, Angola. These were all places that were still struggling for independence. And we think about places like Tanzania, which was the home of the Organization of African Unity's Liberation Committee, and really the kind of meeting point for the black world globally, for the African world globally. And every liberation movement had a post office in Dar es Salaam.
Right.
And this also became a huge place of interest for African-American activists, people who were avoiding the Vietnam War, some people who were looking for a new alternative, others interested in entrepreneurial activities, others just wanting to escape and leave the United States and look for something different. But what we see in that activity is a moment where Africa is really at the center of the Black Freedom Movement's agenda. It's at that moment that it really actually takes a mass character, and we see that in the development of African Liberation Day in 1972, where we had upwards of 50,000 people in gather in Washington, D.C., and probably about half of that number in San Francisco in May. And from 72, 73, 74, we had major African Liberation Day activities, ALD, as it would come to be called. And this, of course, was significant because it involved the community folk. It wasn't just a handful of activists, but it involved everyday people who were, you know, talking about Crest toothpaste and how it supported apartheid. And
so it wasn't mostly an intellectual movement.
Exactly.
More,
you know, right. People were opposed to Polaroid, you know, as a, you know, the film maker, because Polaroid, of course, used its, you know, Polaroid film was used to make passbook pictures in South Africa, and there was a whole movement. There was a group called the Polaroid Revolutionary Workers Movement out of Boston that was very small, but was opposed, you know, led a campaign against Polaroid. So there was a popular interest, right? And if we think about, you know, then musically, you have all this amazing exchange between people like Fela Kuti and Roy Ayers and James Brown and Orlando Julius and, you know, the sort of Afrobeat movement, of course, which was inspired in many respects by what was happening in the U.S. And then the way that Afrobeat movement also, of course, inspired people like Roy Ayers and other kinds of instrumentalists in the early 70s. So there's this real interesting moment of cross-fertilization. You have Gil Scott-Heron in 72, 73, you know, write, you know, the song Johannesburg and, you know, and the cover of that album featured a gorilla that was armed with his hand in both, you know, South Africa and South Carolina. So there was this moment. Now, let's fast forward, just taking my own experience. If you take the, like, early, you know, sort of looking at the 1980s where you have the anti-apartheid movement was in full throttle. Right. And for me as a young person and as in high school and so forth, living in L.A., you know, I got involved in the you know, protesting artists who perform in South Africa. So kind of my, one of my inroads into kind of activism as a young person was really around anti-apartheid work. And that really developed, and I think for those of us who came of age in the late 80s and into 90, into the 90s who were coming out of high school and going into college and so forth, we also see this sort of response to the anti-apartheid activity coming from hip-hop artists, you know, people like Public Enemy,
right.
KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions. All of these artists, you know, were essentially expressing, you know, the Nation of Gods and Earths, the 5%ers were all expressing interest in Africa. So at the popular level, we begin to see this movement activity around anti-apartheid reflected in the music. And that's how a lot of young people came to Africa. To, and then all the you know, the medallions, the Africa medallions, you know, just all those things, you know, really kind of propelled, you know, an interest, you know. And so, you know, it is a sort of Afrocentric wave of scholarship kind of reemerges that had been around for many years, but reemerges with a vengeance. And in the mid 80s, Temple University starts the first African American studies PhD program in the late 80s and admits its first group of students. They sort of harness the program around a very, you know, kind of, you know, strong Afrocentric curriculum. So Afrocentricity, you know, is kind of on the rise at the same time that police brutality and the prison industrial complex and crack cocaine and all those things are also on the rise in the U.S.
Right.
And that was how I think that from my perspective, you know, I was always remember just, you know, being around a lot of folks who were always trying to figure out how to get to Africa. You know, every summer somebody was trying to figure out how they were going to get there. A buddy of mine went to Kenya. I was always trying to figure it out. And I finally, you know, moved to Zimbabwe for a year in 93-94. But, you know, but my interest was both political and in terms of just the art. The art was reflecting that, you know. Now, everybody wasn't going. You know, everybody wasn't down with Africa. You know, everybody wasn't, you know, interested and so forth. But there was, I would say, a critical mass. But now if we think about the contemporary moment, you know, I mean, Africa is so marginal in international politics in terms of how people think about the world, talk about the world. We saw that with Rwanda.
Right.
You know, I mean, genocide take place, you know, a million people killed in, you know, 90 days and just a total disinterest. As if it's Africans are just, you know, subhuman. They don't matter. They're collateral damage of modernity. Who cares? We see this sort of AIDS crisis, of course, on the continent. We saw, you know, South Africa get free, but we also see some of the a lot of the challenges in the post-colonial African world manifesting themselves there, where black people are still lacking education and all kinds of things. So the point is that, you know, that there definitely has been an ebb in interest, but a lot of that ebb is also reflective of sort of larger social political issues and geopolitics in terms of where Africa fits. And our challenge at this particular moment is to put Africa back on the agenda square and center. And there are people out there doing it, is, you know, all over the world. You know, people are doing wonderful, wonderful work. But it's these initiatives are kind of disparate. They're not, we can't talk about them as a full-scale global movement, even though at the cultural level, if we think of reggae music, we think of dancehall, we think of Afrobeat, we think of, you know, black music writ large, there's still these constant reverberations and discussions about the continent and this cross-fertilization. And we see that, of course, with hip-hop as an explosion all over the continent in the late, you know, from the 90s up until the present moment. So, it's a roundabout way. You know, yeah, there's some ebbs and flows, but we also have to think about, you know, what the larger context is at this particular moment. And so, you know, as Africa continues to grapple with structural adjustment and, you know, continues to grapple with, you know, the kind of inequities, you know, north-south inequities, you know, we're gonna, we've got to pick up our work, you know, to sort of, you know, bring to the fore what those challenges are. And young people are going to be at the forefront because, as we know, Africa is majority youth.
And it's going to be increasingly so with the AIDS especially.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
So, yeah, just along the same lines answering that question, I want to say a couple of things at the outset. I think initially when you talk about diaspora, that's a lot of places. You know what I'm saying? And so I want to apologize to anybody who might be from Brazil or India or the Caribbean or Mexico or anybody, any place like that, because, again, the diaspora is a very, very broad place. People who are, as Dr. Fanon mentioned or Wilkins mentioned earlier, you have inter-African diasporas. And so there's a lot of notions that are totally going to be not or left off the table out of this discussion. And then also it's a broad question in terms of the different ways that people approach Africa. And so because answering the question or dealing with these issues that are related to Africa are related to so many other issues, whether you're talking about the environment, you're talking about corporate policy and practices, you're talking about political policies, practices, militarism, you know, gender inequities, health, just a myriad of issues. And so, again, there's just a lot of ways that people can approach this. And so in that sense, I would agree that I think that it can be popular in that sense, in the sense that there's a lot of people probably dealing with a lot of different issues at any particular moment in time. I would say, however, that I don't feel like a serious critical engagement of all those different types of issues, and this is also going to reflect my own personal background. I come from a pretty poor neighborhood in Chicago, you know, on the South Side. It was affectionately referred to as Terrortown, and I can attest to some of that stuff, not to sensationalize, but the point is just that the majority of the folks that I knew growing up were not, you know, scholars. They weren't, you know, they weren't really very professional people. They were hardworking people that, you know, took jobs and worked their jobs or whatever. But a serious critical engagement amongst that group of people in terms of the social analysis, the critical economic and political analysis, I don't think was something that was pervasive, present. Mm-hmm. And as Dr. Wilkins mentioned a moment ago, I think there are elements that manifest themselves in various forms of cultural expression, in particular, and especially, you know, I want to say that I love this thing that I'm about to mention, this hip hop, through hip hop, through forms of dress, through the music itself, the types of music that they incorporated into creating hip hop. So yeah, I think that there were definitely ebbs and flows. And again, because there are so many issues, it's really hard to nail it down in terms of saying, you know, it was this or it definitely was popular. It definitely was not popular. I think even that notion is relative, you know. So you have this notion like, and what's popular in the 70s, you know, or what was popular in the 70s is not as popular in the 90s, you know. Right. What I'm saying? So it's sort of relative. I think that the interest even today is still there in the sense that these notions of Africa or notions of issues that are related to Africa pop up in these popular cultural mediums, in particular, again, through hip hop and neo soul music also should be sort of included there as well, I would think. So it's not that it's gone. It's there. It's just people have, it's because it's not part of the popular discourse.
Right.
You know, I don't think that there's a serious engagement there, but I think that the interest is definitely there. And I would also want to say another thing in terms of the agenda. Africa is, you know, always on the agenda because we are the breadbasket for the world. You find China becoming increasingly involved in, you know, Africa and its liberation movements. And so the question is really not so much about whether or not it's on the agenda. I think the question is whether or not, like, what is its position on that agenda? Who's setting that agenda?
Right.
And then moving forward from there. And so that is that for me is what I'm looking for in terms of creating and also hoping to see in the world, you know, as it relates to Africa and the interest in Africa.
So this level of consciousness, or this, you both believe that there's a certain level of consciousness that is out there, but not quite, you know, in the picture, if you will.
Yeah.
So, and do you actually, at this point, do you actually believe, not actually believe, I really believe that it's going to happen, but I'm asking you two that, do you believe we will ever see that level of consciousness and love for the continent seen in the past generations, into today's generation Y and Z? And if so, where would that come from? Hip hop, you know, whatever. What do you think, Sean?
I think that, you know, history proves that, you know, there will always be an abiding interest, and that interest will, you know, ebb and flow based on, you know, the contemporary political circumstances. Like, again, I mentioned, you know, we saw in the 1920s, you know, a tremendous interest, or we see like in the late 19th century, part of the reason why African Americans in particular in the U.S. were so interested in Africa in the 1890s is because of the backlash of Reconstruction. I mean, it was like Reconstruction was an opportunity, was a moment where, you know, the promises were made to Black people, you know, in terms of rehabilitating or assisting them in the process of rehabilitating themselves post-slavery. And those promises, of course, were broken. And consequently, you know, we saw, you know, racial terror. You know, it was the nadir, what Rayford Logan called the low point of African-American history. And so at that moment, you saw a huge, you know, interest in colonization, a huge interest in leaving the U.S. and living elsewhere. So Liberia and these kind of places all become kind of hotbeds, you know, at that particular moment. Mm-hmm. You know, in the 70s, of course, it's the national liberation movements. You know, again, in the 80s, it's anti-apartheid. Apartheid, after the civil rights Black Power movement, becomes this living example of just overt, gross, you know, racial inequity, you know, right. Injustice. And so, you know, as people begin to try to regroup under the Reagan administration and deal with all the, you know, sort of fallout, you know, and backlash of the, you know, for 60s radicals and COINTELPRO and so forth, you know, apartheid became the kind of place where you could keep your activism alive, that you were, you know, and that struggling for South Africa, you know, was, you know, inextricably connected to your struggle, you know, here in the U.S. So when we think historically, we can see that interest in Africa just depends on what's happening. Like, for example, the Mau Mau, mm-hmm, right, was mm-hmm. a, you know, tremendous interest among the, within the Black press in the U.S. And their, right. and their responses were varied. Some people were opposed or found the Mau Mau deplorable because right. of, quote unquote, some of the British propaganda about them being cannibals and so forth. And then you had African Americans who were like, yo, you know, we totally down with what the Mau Mau and Dedan Kamathi and others are engaged in. So we have to think about, okay, what's on the table? And I think today when we talk about hip hop, oftentimes people like to laugh and say, well, you know, there's no real political movement with hip hop. Right. But I think what you have to think about is that popular culture matters because popular culture is a space that we can, you know, examine where people are essentially, you know, this is where you're feeling for society and the world is structured, you know, is measured. This is where you can engage it, you know, and it's also a place where people rehearse what they can't actually often do in the real world. So that's why Dead Prez or any of these kind of groups are important, because they are expressing sentiments mm-hmm. that they you know, they have a, you know, they believe in, they're serious about, but the contemporary political landscape doesn't necessarily allow for those sentiments to take on a real life, you know, mm-hmm. oftentimes. But we can't, you know, not talk about those things. We have to say that, you know, these things are important because they help us understand what's on people's minds, what their desires are. So we have to always think about the political stakes. And when we think about the political stakes and the in the moment that we're in and what's at, you know, and what's possible and what's not possible, you know, then we can really make more sense and really appreciate popular culture in a serious way.
Thank you, Dr. Wilkins, and we'll be right back. Enjoy the music.
Bye.
Welcome back. Again, I'm joined by Sean Tondi and Dr. Fanon Chair Wilkins, all of them from the University of Illinois. And we're continuing our discussion with about African Americans and their contributions or in Africa. And rather, we're talking about the African continent and African Americans in the diaspora, in the, well, the African diaspora for that. in any case, I want to ask this question. It's one of those things that are again, it's in people's mind, but no one really wants to attempt to answer or challenge this notion. Anyway, but the question is that there seems to be some prolonged issues of reconciliation between the two groups, and by that I mean Africans and Africans in the diaspora, including, of course, the United States. And in this case, I was asked, you know, are those issues legit? And do we all need that reconciliation, or is the reconciliation already in progress in our own subtle way? We'll start with Sean with this one.
Okay. Prolonged issues of reconciliation between the groups. I think that they are real. They are legitimate. They are also varied. And so... And there's also multiple people who are responsible for making that reconciliation come to fruition, and so I think it's difficult to answer the question without really seriously engaging the ideas of like what exactly is the reconciliation issue. Do you feel like that the African Americans have abandoned you, and if you're an African on the continent, which is a very big place again. Do you feel like, and then expanding that also to the rest of the diaspora? I know that a lot of animosity has existed between African American scholars and Brazilian scholars, or just South America, Latin American scholars, black Latin American scholars, in the sense that they feel like a lot of the discourse that's out there has been heavily slanted towards dealing with issues that are related to African Americans, not necessarily just this whole sort of African diaspora period,
which
would include them. Feeling like so feeling abandoned would be real, and then the question is like whose responsibility it is. Is it? I think it's something that even Malcolm X brought up in his travels to Africa, mentioning, you know, like you know, you African leaders look very hypocritical when you, you know, are asking or indicting, you know, these European nations for the atrocities and the crimes against humanity that they have perpetrated in Africa or in their particular respective nations, without indicting these same countries for their practices in their own locations, you know. So speaking in this case, he's speaking specifically about American racism and imperialism and its impact on the black community in the States. Do we need it? Certainly we do need it. And this is one of the things that I think is, in terms of my own engagement with material and in my classes and just with people in general, even the sense that we need, we black people in this world, okay, are in a particular position that is not the same as, you know, let's say the northern bloc, you know what I'm saying? My euphemism or my, yeah, my euphemism. And so a lot of times we try to adopt, in particular, I'm speaking specifically about some civil rights legislation. We try to adopt these policies and practices that apply and work very well in some respects, limited, but some respects for your average European American. But given our special circumstances, you know, and I even hate to gloss over that experience with that phrase. But given our circumstances, we cannot apply the same policies and practices to ourselves, trying to ameliorate our conditions that the European will use to ameliorate his or her own in all instances. Okay. And so this need to reconcile, to be together in that sense, you know, to sort of formulate our own policies, our own practices, to sort of get our own heads together. And that does not exclude, you know, European people from participating in that process. I feel like, you know, anybody who's got a progressive, critical, you know, sort of frame of mind can participate, you know, with some sort of, well, with some limitation, let's just say it like that. I think it's absolutely necessary, and it is underway. There are, again, there's all these issues that affect us are so broad, you know, whether, again, whether it's your environmental policy, whether it's water, AIDS, you know, fluoride levels in the things that you purchase or whatever. They're so broad,
right?
That there's no way that you can't be involved, I think, as a person, as a human being almost. And so again, there are efforts underway to reconcile. And then it's just a matter of what is your area of, you know, a reconciliation. Is it about a religious thing? Is it a, you know, man, woman thing? You know, what is a woman, woman thing? You know what I'm saying? What is it? So I think that the efforts are definitely underway.
Okay. Dr. Wilkins?
Yeah. I think that, you know, what I've always found interesting, particularly moving to the Midwest over the last 3-4 years and teaching at the University of Illinois, is that a good deal of my students, I teach the Introduction to African American Studies, and that class tops off at 200 students. And usually, probably out of 200 students, I probably have 25 to maybe even upwards of 40 black students in the class who have continental African parents, but who grew up in Chicago. So, for example, you have people, you know, I have a student named Malicia Bonsa, right, whose parents are Ghanaian, but she's culturally in every way African-American. This is all she really knows, even though she's spent time in Ghana and other places, you know, as growing up. But, you know, this is really her referent point for her own, you know, cultural background and so forth. But what's interesting is that there is a, you know, we have a community, you know, developing communities like that all over the United States. And it's rich, but it's also complicated in the sense that, you know, for example, a good number of, you know, like you take the Ivy League institutions, some elite institutions, the kids that they're accepting into those schools, particularly students of color and particularly black students, oftentimes aren't African American, but are continental African and Caribbean kids who generally come from fairly upwardly mobile families, right? And so on the one hand, this helps universities fill their quotas, but on the other hand, it also produces groups of students who oftentimes, you know, don't feel like they have a strong interest in relating to African Americans. They oftentimes internalize these, you know, these notions of African Americans being lazy and, you know, and so forth and so forth. And that if they just worked harder, they would be better off and so forth and so forth. So that's one development. Then you have, of course, here at the U of I, you have a different development where you have kids who come from the South Side of Chicago, whose parents are continental African, oftentimes professional, but who come here and have a different sensibility, who work and are, you know, connected to African Americans. Americans in every kind of way. And then you have African Americans who have, you know, their own kind of peculiar, you know, issues with, you know, continental Africans based on stereotypes, based on all kinds of things. But what we this has been a longstanding problem, right? But what we see is that through political alliances based around particular kinds of issues, sets of ideas, that's when we begin to see people really bridging the gap, you know, because we have to think, yeah, we have very interesting cultural differences. Mm-hmm. I saw that going to living in Zimbabwe for a year and, you know, and the kind of expectations people had of me as being an African-American who was in graduate school, who's living on, you know, on the continent. You know, my whole thesis and dissertation, PhD dissertation, grew out of my experience, you know, at the 7th Pan-African Congress in Uganda in 1994, which was 20 years after the 6th Pan-African Congress that took place in Dar es Salaam in 74. But that Congress, I saw, you know, all the tension in the diaspora, you know, the Canadian, you know, group and the African-American group and folks from Trinidad and from Guyana and different places who had other, you know, perspectives and positions, and African-Americans who've been living in Nigeria, in East Africa for 20, 30 years. And so this is a range of just interests, differences. But those things are generally worked out politically, and they worked out through, you know, strategic alliances around, you know, ideas and politics that people have in common. And so if we just kind of just think things and think, you know, so like, you know, Sean mentioned water, environment, AIDS, all these kind of issues. If we think about these things as sort of pivots to organize around, to think collaboratively around, to, you know, we need to be talking more about, you know, people need to, you know, this whole notion that black folks, you know, are, you know, in the U.S. don't work hard and they're lazy and backward in this kind of way that, you know, that Caribbean and African immigrants oftentimes come with those ideas that have been, you know, internalized for a variety of reasons. You know, part of our work is to reverse those ideas, you know, to say that, you know, demystify them, show them, you know, if hard work made you rich, black people would be the richest people in, in the hemisphere.
Yeah, exactly.
So we know hard work doesn't translate into, you know, we go to the continent, you see, you know, folks, you know, working so hard, man, people in Dar es Salaam walking around with charcoal on their back and pushing carts all day and, you know, and making, you know, less than a dollar a day to survive and, you know, and so forth. So, So we just have to, you know, it's an ongoing struggle. And I think oftentimes people think that it's just supposed to be some natural coming together because of, you know, our biological, the way we kind of share certain genes and so forth.
Like the phenotype.
But, yeah, you know, phenotypical, similarities. But, you know, but beyond that, we, you know, that you know, we have to, you know, we have to get in. I mean, you know, just recently, Orlando Patterson, you know, prominent professor at Harvard University, you know, from Jamaica, who was actually, you know, at an earlier point of his life in part of a study circle with C.L.R. James, a Trinidadian activist in London. But you know, Orlando Patterson has been a fierce critic of black life in the U.S. context. And he's now, you know, sort of profiting that part of the reason black people are struggling here is because of cultural differences. They have some. So he's actually reverted to thinking about, you know, culture as a place to talk about black deviance and, you know, and so forth and so forth. All of which, of course, you know, had a new lease on life under the Reagan administration, through the Bushes, you know, Clinton and so forth and so forth. So, you know, our task is to continue to wage ideological, intellectual, political warfare, you know, and bring young people into the fold, you know, connect with artists, you know, engage in kind of cross, you know, collaboration, take our intellectual work seriously and see it as, you know, ideas that can really have an impact on how people think and consequently, you know, make some material difference in people's lives, you know, and that's why we can't belittle what we do and you know, and think that what we do is, you know, is inherently problematic and so forth. We got to take it seriously, you know, put it to the fore for that. So,
yeah, let me make a quick suggestion before we get out of here. I want to ask if, maybe before we get out of here, we can put on the table some places where people can find alternative sources of information regarding Africa, African-Americans, or Africans in the diaspora.
Okay.
Like a Pan-Africa TV or Pan-Africa.tv is one side. That's why, so.
Okay. Thank you, to both of my guests today, Sean Tondi and Professor Fanon Wilkins, and
thank you.
Yeah, thank you, brother.
Thank you, and we know how it is, man. Aluta continua, right? Yeah. Again, I would like to say thank you for listening to Liberation Radio, or as we call it,
Liberación Radio Colectivo.
Yeah, man. And this segment and this program has been produced by a group of students at the University of Illinois. We will be on WEFT 90.1 every month, and that is every second Sunday of the month. Thanks again. Peace.
Yeah, and actually, it'll be on at 10 a.m., just so you know the time. 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. every month and every second Sunday of every month.
Thank you very much. Okay, folks, we're about to be out of here. Enjoy some Afrobeat by the Sahara All Stars. And again, I would like to thank my engineer right here, my right hand man, Andrew Kennis. Again,
thank you very much.
Next time,
glad to be here.
Police agbowa bo ba sanwo mi adajo agbowa Professor Long, Professor Long, oh, Professor Long, oh, Professor Long.